From WYPR, I'm Sheila Cast. We're on the record. A spunky African-American teenager adopted into a Jewish family in Baltimore, trying to sort out her identity. That's the nub of the new young adult novel, The Length of a String. We ask author Alyssa Brent Weissman what inspired the story and whether she's the right person to tell it. Then a very different novel by a local author, Michael Downs, The Strange and True Tale of Horace Wells, fiction filling in the story of the 19th century dentist who first used laughing gas to numb the pain of surgery.
He became addicted to the nitrous oxide, to chloroform, to ether, to all those vapors that he self-experimented with. That was the way people did science then. And he didn't even probably know he was addicted. This was all so new.
It's On the Record after the news.
You're listening to On the Record, the podcast, a service of your public radio, 88.1 WYPR. Find more podcasts online at wypr.org. And tell us what you think. Send an email to ontherecord@wypr.org.
Good morning, I'm Sheila Cast. We're On the Record. Two Baltimore fiction writers are publishing two very different novels in the next week, which gives us a chance to get their views on how and why they write. A bit later, we'll meet Towson University professor Michael Downs, who has discovered or created, I'm not sure which, a love story in 19th century dentistry. Right now, Alyssa Brent Weissman is with us. She's written the Nerd Camp stories for young people, and we spoke with her last summer when she wrote about how other writers got started writing a book called Our Story Begins. Weissman's new book for young readers is titled The Length of a String. It weaves together the thoughts of 12-year-old Imani, an African-American girl adopted by a Jewish family in Baltimore, and the diary of another 12-year-old three generations earlier who escaped the Holocaust. Welcome back to On the Record, Alyssa.
Thank you. So happy to be here.
So probably every 12-year-old is sorting out identity issues, but Imani has a lot to sort out.
She does.
Tell us about her.
She is preparing for her bat mitzvah, and she lives in a suburb of Baltimore where she's one of the only black people that she knows, and certainly in her Hebrew school. And so she's always wondered about her birth parents, and her family never talks about her adoption. So she's working up the nerve to ask for a very controversial gift for her bat mitzvah, which is to find her birth parents.
There is a wonderful scene early on when Imani meets another young teenager who is completely rude when she realizes Imani is adopted. Would you read us part of that?
Sure. My opponent was a tall, muscular girl with blonde hair and red braces. We met at the net to determine who'd serve first, and she pointed with her racket to my family. Who are they? My dad and my brother? Her face contorted with confusion. Is your mom black? I'm used to strangers asking me obnoxious questions that are none of their business. What I'm not used to is playing singles, and fielding obnoxious questions right now could mess with my head. I needed to shut this down, but I was too nervous for the game to do anything but tell the truth. I'm adopted, I said. Heads or tails? But she couldn't have cared less about tossing the coin for that first serve. That's so cool. Have you ever met your real parents? I live with them, I said coldly. No, like your real parents. You know, biologically or whatever. Do you know them? No. You should find them, suggested this total stranger. You might have this amazing history you don't know about. Thank you, I thought sarcastically. That never occurred to me until you brought it up. Heads or tails, I asked again.
Why did you want us to see Imani reacting to those questions?
One thing that surprised me a lot when I was writing this book, I spoke with a good friend of mine who's adopted. She's adopted from Mexico, and she's Jewish, like me, and we went to Hebrew school together. And I spoke with her about her experience of being adopted, and I, as someone who's known her entire life, I was very nervous to ask her these questions about her adoption, and here I was doing it as a friend and someone who was writing a book. And when I asked her, she started laughing, and she thought it was adorable how nervous I was, because she said whenever she tells people she's adopted, total strangers, if it happens to come up, they suddenly ask her tons and tons of obnoxious questions, and they always ask her if she has found her birth parents, if she's going to find her birth parents. They try to convince her to find her birth parents. And this surprised me to no end. I couldn't believe that this happens all the time. And I spoke to other adoptees who had very similar stories. And I thought, well, here I'd better include something like that in the book to be authentic to Imani's experience. And it was a good opportunity, too, early in the book to show Imani's character with the way that she reacts to the sort of things that happened to her.
Yeah, pretty tough, sarcastic. That's all Imani.
Yes, absolutely. And yet inside her head, she really is kind of wondering these same things, too, that people are asking her. But she says, you know, this is my life. I'm allowed to wonder about these things. You know, what's it to this girl?
Imani's great-grandmother, her mother's grandmother, Grandma Anna, dies in New York where she lives. And Imani doesn't know Grandma Anna very well, but she has an enormous impact on Imani.
She does. At first, when great-grandma Anna dies, Imani hardly feels anything, and she almost wonders, am I a cold, heartless person for not feeling anything while she's at the funeral? But then Imani discovers that Anna has left her all of her books, along with Imani's brother and their cousin get all of the books. And when Imani is going through those books, she finds one of them is actually a diary that her great-grandmother kept when she was 12, the same age Imani is now. And once Imani starts reading it, she discovers a lot of parallels in their story, because Anna, at the age of 12, was sent across the ocean from Nazi-occupied Luxembourg to live with a new family in Brooklyn, New York.
That's writer Alyssa Brent Weissman here on The Record on WYPR. I'm Sheila Cast. She'll launch her new novel, The Length of a String, on Sunday afternoon at After's Cafe in Federal Hill. Your novel starts with what we broadcasters would call a cold open. No preface, no foreword. We are immediately reading that diary. Why did you want us to plunge immediately into Anna's diary?
I like that term, cold. I kind of wanted it to be sort of a splash of cold water in the face, I guess, to see, you know, that first diary entry. I know it might be a little bit disorienting for readers to figure out what's going on, but the diary is written as a series of letters that Anna writes to her twin sister, Belle, whom she had to leave behind when she left Europe by herself. And she talks about having to leave behind her twin and being all alone crossing the ocean. And I actually had the idea for that part of the book, for Anna's story, after listening to an episode of the Diane Rehm Show on NPR, where people were calling in who were children of Holocaust survivors. And one of them called in and said her father was a survivor. His parents had saved up money. They had many children. They'd saved up money to save two and send them away. And when they got to the boat or wherever the smuggler said, sorry, price doubled. And now they could only afford to send one. And I thought, wow, what a story. The story of that person. I think in that real life story, the person who got sent was about 16, but I made her younger, at 12. And I said if she had to leave by herself across the ocean, leaving behind even a twin sister, what a story that would be. And I thought that's the way I wanted to start the book.
You know, I feel the parallels between Imani's situation as an adopted teenager and Anna's situation leaving her family, but I can't really articulate why. I mean, as far as we know, Imani is not a twin. What is the root of that parallel?
It's true. It's not so much a direct parallel. Imani was adopted as a baby. She's never known her first family, whereas Anna lived many years, 12 years, with the rest of her first family before moving and moving to a new family. I guess it's just kind of that sense of wondering always, that Imani sort of feels like she's just always wondering what else there is about her, where she comes from to some degree. And Anna has that same sense of wondering as she is leaving and she doesn't know what's happening to her family in Europe. And part of what kind of lends a gravity to the story is that most readers know what's happening to Anna's family in Holocaust era Europe.
But let me ask you about that, too, because it does loom in the back of our minds. We sort of gradually realize there's not going to be a happy ending, but we don't know it all at once. Did you plan that, or what is your expectation about when young readers are going to realize that Anna is losing her family?
I think it'll probably depend on the young reader's prior knowledge of the Holocaust, I would say. I didn't want to write a standard or typical Holocaust book. I had absolutely no interest in kind of telling the story of people who were put into concentration camps, or I mean, I think that's been done many times and done very well, and I don't know that I'm the right person to do that. So instead, this story plays out at that time period, but it plays out on the home front in Brooklyn in 1941. And nobody really knew just how terrible everything was and what was going on. I'm trying to play into that. And I think that, and especially in a book for young readers, leaving that space and leaving some gaps for them to bring some prior knowledge and maybe learn some other things. And Imani learns about the Holocaust as she goes, as she's reading Anna's story. So that will help them along, too. I think it'll depend how much people know going in, and then there will be more that unfolds as the story goes on.
You mentioned that you're not sure you would be the right person to write a strictly Holocaust memory book. Are you the right person to write about an African-American teenager grappling with her identity?
That's an excellent question. And that's a big question that's going on right now in the literary world and in the greater culture about cultural appropriation. And I think it's a very valid point that perhaps I'm not. But I had this idea. It was based very heavily on good friends of mine growing up. And I tried to be as true to Imani's character as I could be. I spoke with many adoptees. I had 4 sensitivity readers read the book and then weigh in on the racial aspects. And that was very helpful and very interesting. Although the main thing I took away from that experience, it certainly made the book better, was that each of those 4 readers had different feedback because everybody has a different experience and a different perspective on all of those things. So I'm not trying to speak in any way for any large group of people. I'm trying to speak for one character, a fictional character who I invented, who even though she doesn't look like me, she grew up in a family very similar to mine and is in many ways almost more like me than any of the other characters I've ever written.
Well, congratulations on the book.
Thank you so much.
Elissa Brent Weissman's newest young adult novel is The Length of a String. She'll be speaking and signing books Sunday at 2 p.m. at After's Cafe, 1001 South Charles Street in Baltimore. We've got a link to details at the On the Record page at WYPR.org. Short break now on the record, and then we'll reach back a century and a half to a novel that deals with pain, dental pain. I'm Sheila Cass. Stay tuned.
This is the On the Record podcast, a service of Your Public Radio, member-supported 88.1 WYPR. You can support this podcast and everything you hear from WYPR. Become a member. Come to WYPR.org and click the donate link.
Welcome back to On the Record. I'm Sheila Cast. From our 21st century perspective, it's hard to imagine having a tooth pulled or a serious incision without something to numb the pain. But our understanding of pain and what can quell it lagged behind many medical procedures that caused it. It wasn't until 1844 that a dentist encountered a substance that until then was carnival entertainment, laughing gas, and figured out it could ease the agony of his patients. How did this insight come about? What did it take to spread the word? History didn't capture much of the detail, and so Towson University Associate Professor of English Michael Downs has stepped in with a novel that fills in the gaps. It's titled The Strange and True Tale of Horace Wells, Surgeon Dentist. And Michael Downs is here in the studio to tell us about it. Welcome to the show.
Thanks so much for having me here.
Horace Wells is a real figure in history, right? You did not create this character.
No. He's from Hartford, Connecticut, where I was born. He's buried in Hartford, Connecticut, in the same cemetery as my grandparents.
What else should we know about him?
He lived a very short life, and he had a kind of obsession with pain and solving pain, understandable given his profession. He came up with nitrous oxide as a way to knock people out, though when he tried to spread the word, his most important exhibition of that experiment failed, and he became a laughingstock. He spent the next few years of his life trying to convince people that he had indeed discovered a way to make surgery painless, and those were a very few short years. He had a tragic end.
Where did this obsession with pain come from?
I don't know. And that's one of the questions that I decided to explore in the book. I had to kind of create a reason why he might have been so obsessed with pain. None of his letters talked about it. They only noted in the historic record notes that he would often stop practicing dentistry for weeks or months at a time. And I'm imagining that's because he just couldn't endure the pain that he would cause.
Why did he even go into dentistry? I mean, dentistry, when he entered, was all about inflicting pain.
It was. And so that becomes part of how I imagine it, that he has to have a reason to want to explore pain, a kind of morbid curiosity for it, repelled by it and attracted to it all at the same time. And that was one of my challenges as a writer, to try to imagine a character to understand Horace in a way that would explain why he would be so compelled to pain. In fact, several times other characters in the book ask him, why did you get into dentistry? And I myself have asked several dentists, why did you get into dentistry? And the answers are often about the mechanics of dentistry, that they like the tools, that they like the physical aspect of fixing things. And Horace was a farm boy. And so possibly part of it was simply he liked playing with the tools.
How did Horace Wells become aware of nitrous oxide?
Generally, it seems he'd heard reports about it, about the parties, especially kids at Yale, were medical students at Yale and just regular students were enjoying laughing gas parties. And then a fellow came through town named Gardner Colton, himself a failed medical student, and he put on an exhibition, basically a theater show, in which volunteers could come up and inhale nitrous oxide and then act in strange, goofy ways. And Horace saw that advertisement in the newspaper and convinced his wife that they should go to this show.
How did he test his theory that nitrous oxide could help his patients?
Well, the first thing that happened was a good friend of his who also attended the show ran around like a crazy person through the theater and tried to leap a couch and gashed his leg quite badly. And didn't notice that he had cut himself for several minutes, and in fact said, I didn't even feel anything. And that compelled Horace to go the very next day to Dr. Colton. He called himself Dr. Colton. He really wasn't a doctor. And say, let me use some of your nitrous oxide for my own tooth pull. I have a tooth that needs to be pulled. He invited his own friend and colleague, John Riggs, to do the tooth pulling. They all sat in Horace's office together while Horace inhaled nitrous oxide to the point that he was unconscious or mostly unconscious. And then his friend Riggs pulled his tooth. He didn't feel anything. And that was the beginning of it.
Would you read for us how you describe that moment?
Sure, I'd be glad to. And then he felt himself breathing. His lungs, no longer waves, had become lungs again. He blinked and saw blinding brightness. He felt the blink. He held his eyes shut a moment. The pulse that had been God's heartbeat seemed now to be a throbbing, as if it were a visitor knocking on his forehead with two knuckles. His mouth tasted of iron. His tongue felt leaden. Still, it moved at his bidding, sort of, so he explored his mouth and found a hole along his gum line where he remembered no hole. He opened his eyes wide with care, and in the brightness he saw Riggs in his apron. Riggs held a tooth key, and lodged in the key was a tooth. It looked to him white as could be, as if polished, as if it were the tooth of an angel. Did you feel it, Wells? Did you feel the tooth pull? He had not. He had not, and even as he felt tired, wanting to sleep, the awareness that the angel tooth Riggs held was his own sparked through him like some celestial fire.
So that was when Horace Wells knew nitrous oxide could mask pain.
Yes. Yeah. It's a pretty exciting moment. I mean, in human history, when had that ever happened before?
That's Towson University English professor Michael Downes here on the record on WYPR. I'm Sheila Cast. We're talking about his new novel, The Strange and True Tale of Horace Wells, Surgeon Dentist. Downes has won fellowships from the National Endowment for the Arts, the Maryland State Arts Council, and the Greater Baltimore Cultural Alliance for earlier works. How did he try to get this accepted as medical practice, as dental practice?
Well, where he lived in Hartford was provincial, and Boston was the place where medicine was happening. And so he brought nitrous oxide there and, through a friend, arranged to have an exhibition of it to pull a tooth in what is now Massachusetts General Hospital before John Collins Warren, who was the preeminent surgeon of the time. He failed in that exhibition. No one knows quite why, but when Horace pulled the tooth, the patient whimpered, just a whimper. But it was enough that he was immediately disbelieved, this dentist from the provinces. And famously, the people in the gallery watching began to call out, humbug, humbug, this is just a humbug. And it broke Horace. He essentially had a nervous breakdown afterward.
How did you research this book? How much is history? How much is from your imagination?
A lot of it is history. A lot of it is from my imagination. I decided early on that I didn't want to change any of the aspects of Horace's life that are established and known. Certainly novelists have permission to do that. But if Horace only had one son, I wasn't going to give him two sons. So I stuck pretty close to the known facts about Horace's life. There are enough gaps, enough things that we don't know, that I could step in and imagine. And a lot of those had to do with the things that most interest a novelist, motivation, secrets, that sort of thing. But to create the world, to create the 19th century world, required an awful lot of research. One of the things I did was make sure I used the Oxford English Dictionary, and I tried not to use words that weren't in use at the time. So you won't find an early 20th century word in the novel. And another thing that was really helpful that I did was I visited Connecticut and a historical society there that has a lot of ephemera connected with Horace, including his death mask. And at the time that I visited, I wasn't quite accessing Horace as a character. My wife was reading the novel and she was saying she didn't like Horace. He wasn't appealing. I wasn't getting at what made him real. And when I visited this museum and I held his death mask with little white gloves on my hands and I touched his face, I touched Horace Wells' face, and I tried to do it as if I were his wife, who's another main character in the book, and to know how she must have felt touching his face after he had died. And somehow that opened Horace up for me. Through his wife, through touching his death mask, I gained affection for him and came to understand him better, I think, and appreciate him more. And I think that was a big part of the novel's breakthrough for me.
Why do you call this a love story?
Because it is between Horace and Elizabeth, story, his wife. Yeah. He became addicted to the nitrous oxide, to chloroform, to ether, to all those vapors that he self-experimented with. That was the way people did science then. And he didn't even probably know he was addicted. This was all so new. And she endured all that, and she worked with him, worked with the man she had, and loved him. And in my imagining, a lot of what he does is for her, too. A lot of his own suffering is because he loves her and wants to help her avoid some pains. So, yeah, I do think it's a love story.
Is there a lesson in this fictionalized history for us today in the midst of an epidemic of prescription painkillers?
Wow, that's a great question. I don't know if there's a lesson, except maybe when you think about it, the utter destruction of pain in this country in a way begins with Horace Wells, who became addicted. So that our current opioid epidemic is, in a sense, nothing new. you know, from nitrous oxide to laudanum to other opium tinctures that followed. It seems to be human nature to struggle with pain and the substances that relieve pain, that we don't really know how to do it right. And we should always be exceedingly careful about it and not think that we always have the new answer. Horace thought he had the answer. But as one character in the book says, the moment you figure out a way to annul one kind of pain, someone else is going to figure out a way to cause new pain. And I think that carries through even in the use of the drugs and substances that we use to get rid of pain.
Very interesting book. Congratulations.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
Michael Downs, Associate Professor of English at Towson University. His new novel is The Strange and True Tale of Horace Wells, Surgeon Dentist. He'll be speaking about it next Thursday evening, May 10th, at the Ivy Bookstore on Falls Road, 7 p.m. More information about the book and the event at the On the Record page at WIPR.org. I'm Sheila Cass. Glad you've been with us this morning. Come back tomorrow.
Thanks for listening to this segment of On the Record with Sheila Cast. You can catch the show on the radio Monday through Friday, 9:30 to 10 a.m. on 88.1 WYPR, your NPR news station. And you can support On the Record and all the other public radio programs that WYPR brings to you. Just click the donate link at the top of WYPR.org. And thanks.